Welcome, listeners, to a new episode of Criminal Mind, a brand new true crime podcast that delves into shocking cases that all tie into mental health. I'm Raviv, and this week's episode highlights a case that is more high profile than the ones discussed in previous episodes. I usually want to cover cases that aren't as well known, but this one is so centered around mental health, I just had to delve into it. Thank you so much to everyone who's listened to this podcast so far. I've covered three cases across our first three episodes: the Waffle House shooting, Christy Sheets, and Stephanie Diane Smith. The case I'm chatting about today took me 2 weeks to research, organize, and cover, which is why there was no new episode last week. I anticipated this being done for last Wednesday, but vetting through all of the resources and trying to piece it all together in podcast format was so much more difficult than I initially expected. Today, we're falling into the complex case of murderer Andrew Goldstein, and I just want to preface beforehand that, like the last episode, this one is grim and it may be uncomfortable or upsetting to listen to. Please listen with caution. And with that, let's take a swim in the mind of a criminal. Welcome to Criminal Mind. On January 3rd, 1999, 32-year-old Kendra Webdale was thrown in front of a 400-ton train car at a 23rd Street subway station in Manhattan by Andrew Goldstein, a schizophrenic who lived just a short distance away from her. Kendra stood alone on the platform, and Andrew Goldstein approached her to ask for the time. Although he didn't seem like a volatile man, Goldstein already had a well-documented history of both violence and mental illness. At the time, the 29-year-old Goldstein was unemployed, according to NBC News, and had no money to spare after paying his rent with the disability money that he received from the state. A smart student, Goldstein excelled in high school, but began to experience disorientation, delusional thoughts, and violent behavior during his freshman year of college. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 1989 after a violent encounter with his mother, where he pushed her into a wall. We briefly touched upon schizophrenia in a previous episode, but I just want to delve into a bit more detail about it again. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, quote, "Schizophrenia is a serious mental illness that affects how a person thinks, feels, and behaves. People with schizophrenia may seem like they have lost touch with reality, which causes significant distress for the individual, their family member, and friends," end quote. There's a wide scale of symptoms that people with schizophrenia experience, including hallucinations, delusion, paranoia, difficulty focusing, lack of motivation, and disorganized speech. Schizophrenia can be disabling if not treated, and although there are a variety of treatment options available, this is a mental illness that's incredibly tough to properly diagnose. Andrew Goldstein had been spinning around the revolving doors of treatment. It seems as though he wanted to seek help. New York Times reporter Michael Winterip had a look at Andrew's psychiatric case file, and documents revealed that he had gone to a local hospital many times begging them for help, saying that he wanted to be, quote, normal and live. He was given the medication Haldol, which is an antipsychotic drug. He was hesitant to take the medication. Most mental health medications have side effects, and some are debilitating. Some mental health medications can make the pre-existing struggles worse. While it's commendable that he initially brought himself to the hospital to seek treatment, chose to go, he chose to stay, and he chose to tell the staff that he needed help, it is difficult to treat schizophrenia without the use of medication. In 1992, he chose to go off of his medication. And I've talked about this in a previous episode as well, but it is very dangerous to just stop taking mental health medication, especially if you've been taking it for an extended period of time. It is very likely for one's symptoms to worsen if they just stop taking it. After going off of his medication, Goldstein began to experience worsened delusions. Consistent treatment truly is the key to combating mental health struggles. Goldstein didn't seem to be able to uphold that consistency, though. He was hospitalized more than 12 times leading up to the murder of Kendra Webdale, and opted to not pursue outpatient treatment once released. Another issue with this, and something that is repeatedly talked about in regards to this case, is the fact that he was released every single time he was hospitalized. All of the medical professionals that treated him deemed him fit to be discharged. I don't know the details of every single hospitalization, like how long each was, how they treated him each time, but it strikes me as odd that despite 12 plus hospitalizations, not a single doctor saw him as a threat to himself, or others. That is the law when it comes to involuntarily institutionalizing someone. They have to be deemed a threat to either themselves or others. So how did not a single doctor think that he was not a threat? In December 1992, Goldstein was hospitalized again at the Creedmoor in Queens, but this time his delusions were worse than ever. According to reporting done for Dateline by NBC News, quote, "Hospital notes portray a man so paranoid and delusional that he barricaded himself in a nurse's station because he believed the staff was, quote, poisoning him with cyanide, end quote, and that someone was after him with a gun," end full quote. At this point, staff did deem him a danger to himself and others, and he was kept at Creedmoor for a short period of time. His behavior and paranoia were getting worse with each hospitalization. During his stay at Creedmoor, he attacked multiple employees. There is a clear pattern in Andrew's behavior, a cycle of sorts that seems to run on repeat between each hospitalization. It seems as if he did well for a short period of time, but then things would just go awry and he'd end up back at the start. This was kind of an odd case to research, and one that honestly just didn't have too many resources about the actual crime itself. So much of what I found outlined what led up to January 3rd, 1999, and a lot more about what happened as a result of his actions. Andrew Goldstein repeatedly cycled through the broken infrastructure of the mental health system, and the lack of consistency in his treatment just made things worse. He stayed at Creedmoor for 8 months, and was then transferred to a group home. He did well at the group home, but most mental health institutions in the state of New York have a documented history of trying to push patients out. What I found really interesting here is that he had the opportunity to go home on the weekends while he was living in the group home, and according to his psychiatric record, he didn't take his medication when he went home. So going off and on with those medications weekly, that lack of general consistency just wouldn't have done him any good. Knowing that, it doesn't surprise me that his streak of good behavior didn't last. Also too, if the doctors at this group home knew that he wasn't taking his medication at home, I'm unsure why they continued to allow him to go home. I'm not completely sure of what their limits were in regards to things that they were legally allowed to make mandatory and what they couldn't, so I'd love to know if they were even allowed to revoke his going home privileges. But it just strikes me as odd that nothing was done to combat this. Essentially, he was just putting meds in his body for a few days, and then taking himself off for a few days, so the levels of his brain chemicals were probably all over the place, and the lack of supervision in this particular regard highlights just how broken the mental health system was at this time. Flash forward to 1996, and Andrew Goldstein is living on his own in the city. He's not with family or friends. Instead, he's living in a basement apartment. It was during this time when his behavior started to shift towards violence yet again. He stopped taking his medications. Nobody in the system checked on him, and the delusions continued to impact his behavior. He had previously been begging hospitals in the area to help him. He didn't want to be like this. He just wanted, more than anything, to be normal. The impulses escalated to another attack, this time on a supermarket customer. At this point in my research, I started to wonder if Andrew Goldstein was capable of living on his own, engaging good hygiene practices, and that led to me wondering if he was capable of even taking his medication. Maybe it wasn't a choice to stop taking his medication intermittently. Maybe his mental illness was so severe that he was unable to take care of himself. The man was taking the steps to go to the hospital many times over the years and asking for help, so I think that a lot of this buildup really comes down on the hospital staff, who released him every single time after just a few days of being admitted. But then, as I kept researching, I came across more information that said that doctors did note that they thought he was a danger to others or himself, and they did note that he wasn't taking his meds correctly or regularly. He wanted to live at a location where he would be helped and he would be watched. This is where the United States healthcare system truly comes into play, because of the overall lack of sufficient mental health resources in this country. Waiting lists, insufficient bed space, minimal doctors and limited appointments. This is still a prevalent issue in the United States to this day. So where did this leave him? He was in the emergency room 10 more times over the next year and a half. According to NBC News, quote, he told doctors that the earth was running out of oxygen, or that he saw people shrinking and then growing, or that he was an Italian music composer, end quote. Each hospital visit varied. Sometimes he brought himself, and other times he was brought in by the police. Shortly before he attacked Kendra Webdale, he was brought into the hospital again and displayed more violent behavior than ever. He attacked a nurse, a doctor, and punched another woman in the face, right between the eyes. But he was released again. What was it going to take for the system to realize that Andrew Goldstein was, in fact, a true threat to others? Andrew's last hospitalization before killing Kendra Webdale was in November 1998. The holidays were a lonely time for him, and he was feeling the weight of that loneliness. He didn't go home to see family, and instead was alone at his apartment. He went to the North General Hospital in Harlem, asking to be admitted for severe schizophrenia. It seemed like he was aware of his diagnosis and how it impacted his behavior, but he was unable to control the delusions and violence. While there, he asked for glasses so he could, quote, find the faces of the voices he heard talking to him, end quote, according to NBC News. On December 11th, psychiatric notes showed that he was still experiencing paranoia and delusions, despite receiving treatment there for 2 weeks. 3 days later, on December 14th, a doctor signed off on discharging him the next day. What could have possibly changed that much over the course of 3 days if he was just experiencing strong delusions and paranoia for an extended period of time? It feels to me like they were just trying to get him out so another bed could be open. Lack of space, lack of resources, lack of pretty much everything. He should not have been released to be on his own. Once the hospital discharged him, they referred him to a local clinic for follow-up. Just straight up, this is bullshit. If a patient is violent and they have a well-documented history of violence due to something as severe as schizophrenia, what the fuck is a local clinic going to do if he's out on the streets attacking people? He's going to end up back in the hospital or arrested or something worse, which is what ended up happening. After years of buildup, years of insufficient care, and increasingly alarming behavior, Andrew Goldstein ended up at the subway station on Broadway and 23rd Street on January 3rd, 1999. 32-year-old Kendra Webdale was standing alone on the platform, 5 feet from the tracks. She read a magazine as she waited for her train to arrive. There were witnesses to the attack, and they stated that Andrew was pacing back and forth, mumbling to himself. What he did next horrified everyone on the platform. With aggression and force, he shoved Kendra Webdale onto the tracks as the train was approaching the platform, killing her instantly. Onlookers were sick, scared. Although the driver of the subway train tried to help her once the train stopped moving, crawling underneath the car, she was already gone. Stephen Ramirez, a witness, said that he asked Andrew why he did it, and Andrew stated, quote, I'm crazy. I'm psychotic. Take me to the hospital, end quote. I truly believe that this could have been avoided. If any of the hospitals that he visited over the years had just listened to him when he begged for help, he would have been living in a group home or institution of sorts and unable to harm anyone on the outside. The National Alliance on Mental Health sent out a press release in the days following Kendra Webdale's death, and something that I found really odd is that they got Andrew's name wrong in the copy. His name is listed as Daniel Goldstein. It might seem like a simple oversight to some, but I think that this error kind of highlights exactly what's wrong with the mental health care system in the US. They don't care enough. A simple error that could have been corrected by just reading the news or editing the press release. Lori M. Flynn, who at the time was the executive director of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, is who released the statement, and it feels like she just couldn't be bothered to get his name correct. I don't know, but just something about reading through the press release gave off an I don't care enough attitude, and that's everything that's wrong with this case. Quote, we also grieve for Daniel Goldstein, 29, whose promise was stolen by schizophrenia over a decade ago. we share the outrage of many New Yorkers over a mental health care system that allows too many people like Mr. Goldstein to fall through the cracks with little, if any, continuity of treatment or case supervision. End quote. You share the outrage for Kendra, whose life was senselessly taken by a man who should not have had access to her. But you also share the outrage for someone who was completely failed by a system that you are a leader of, and you can't even get his name right. The commissioner of New York's Office of Mental Health at the time of the murder, James Stone, was in an impossible position. He had to speak up, and he admitted that there wasn't much communication between the city's hospitals, so Andrew essentially got lost in the system. According to Dateline, the state had 500 case managers who were employed to check on and monitor patients like Andrew, but he was never assigned one. Andrew Goldstein slipped through the cracks, and it made me wonder how many other people like Andrew were just forgotten about in this horrible system. The commissioner couldn't give a reason why he wasn't assigned a case manager, and that is even more troubling. He had thousands of pages of psychiatric notes written about his hospitalizations from different doctors in different hospitals. I just don't get how that much documentation can slip through the cracks. Andrew Goldstein was charged with second-degree murder and put on trial, with a potential maximum prison sentence of 25 years to life. During the first trial, Andrew's lawyers tried to argue that he was insane and didn't know that what he was doing was wrong. This wasn't a trial based on trying to decide whether or not Andrew was guilty or not guilty. He'd tell you that he did it and was aware of that. The focal point of this case was his mental state, but prosecutors tried to argue that since all of his victims of violence were women, he just hated women. The jury was deadlocked, a mistrial was declared, and a second trial was pending. The May 2001 retrial showed Goldstein choosing to plead guilty to first-degree manslaughter at the suggestion of his legal team. The shift in plea and new jury ultimately led to Andrew Goldstein being found guilty and sentenced to serve 23 years in prison. I honestly think that being in prison might have been the best thing for Andrew. Although not a hospital, far from one, he was going to have consistency for really the first time. He was released from prison in 2018 after serving 19 years of his sentence, and there haven't been any updates on his whereabouts now. The holes in the mental health care system, specifically in the state of New York, were now on national display. The cracks were clear, and they were more like sheer breaks. Andrew Goldstein should not have had access to the subway platform that night, but every time he sought help, he was released from care. Much of the blame was shifted to George Pataki, who was New York's governor at the time, and his budget cuts were said to have increased wait times for mental health treatment. The immense public reaction ultimately led to the signing of Kendra's Law, a New York State law that was initially proposed in 1999. There are many pieces to Kendra's Law, so I just want to outline the two main sections. Also occasionally known as AOT, Assisted Outpatient Treatment. Kendra's Law, quote, allows courts, after due process, to order a certain group of narrowly defined individuals with serious mental illness who already have a past history of multiple arrests, incarcerations, or needless hospitalizations to accept treatment as a condition for living in the community. Before Kendra's Law, the law required people so ill they refused treatment to become dangerous before they can be required to accept treatment. Families felt the law should prevent dangerous behavior rather than require it. Kendra's Law allows judges to order the recalcitrant mental health system to serve people with serious mental illness rather than cherry-picking the easiest to treat for admission, end quote, as written in a synopsis by mentalhealthpolicy.org. The first part of Kendra's Law that I think directly addresses what happened with Andrew Goldstein is the fact that an individual can be ordered to treatment without them being considered an immediate threat, meaning that they're a danger to themselves or others. The basis here is prevention, and that's where we saw a lot of things go haywire in the system with Andrew Goldstein. A patient does not need to be hospitalized under Kendra's Law. They can be court-ordered to various types of treatment, and that variety is much more multifaceted and personalized to each individual's needs. Kendra Webdale's mother, Patricia, has been an outspoken supporter of Kendra's law and stated that, quote, Kendra died because of purposefully ineffectual laws and policies that prevent treatment for those with severe mental illnesses, many of whom are too ill to make informed treatment decisions, end quote, according to New York Mag. Her statement shows empathy, which is just so respectable and commendable given the emotional turmoil that her family has experienced. I don't know many people, especially those who have lost a child, who would have this kind of empathy or dedication to advocate for those who are mentally ill. Andrew Goldstein was released from prison in 2018 after serving 19 years of his 23-year sentence. The details of his release have not publicly been made clear, but State Senator Catherine Young has stated that he was moved to an undisclosed state facility where he'll continue to receive treatment. While in prison, he was classified as SMI-V, which means seriously mentally ill, violent. He was given a cocktail of various antipsychotic medications: Haldol, Cogentin, Abilify, Zyprexa. He viewed the cocktail as puzzle pieces. Quote, it makes me feel like a jigsaw puzzle that patterns out, end quote, he said in an interview with New York Mag. Although his prison records state that he was unable to maintain basic self-care and hygiene during his incarceration, he hasn't had a documented violent incident since 2003. Teased relentlessly in prison, he somehow still maintained a calm, almost docile demeanor, which was nearly the opposite of his aggressive manner before. The consistency of his medication regimen seemed to put his delusions at ease, and I wish that there was any kind of update about where Andrew Goldstein is now to see if that's still the case. Kendra Webdale was a wide-eyed dreamer, a bold, ambitious, driven writer from Buffalo who came to New York City seeking a life full of creative inspiration. She was an avid 5:30 a.m. runner. She had been working on a screenplay and spent hours in the library researching for it. There were so many individual passions and dreams that Kendra Webdale wanted to explore in New York City that were mindlessly stolen from her with just a push. Yet, her family says that she would have wanted to help Goldstein if she could. And in my opinion, that speaks the most about Kendra Webdale. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into another episode of Criminal Mind. This one was super hard to put together. I found this case incredibly difficult to read about and hard to stomach, but I thought it was important to discuss. Again, I usually like to chat about lesser-known cases, but the introduction of Kendra's law shows just how significant this case is and the impact that it's had on society. I listed the sources used to write this episode in the description box, and I urge you to read through any of them. There were a lot of legalities involved in this case, especially during Andrew's initial trial and through the creation of Kendra's law, that I wasn't able to fit into this episode. So many more pieces to the legal side of this and the aftermath. So go take a look at some of those links and you'll see how the aftermath of Kendra Webdale's murder is still playing a crucial role in the mental health care system, especially in the state of New York. As always, if you have any suggestions for cases or criminals that you think fit into the overall theme of Criminal Mind and you want me to discuss in an episode, reach out to me on socials at IamRevive across the board. If you like what you're hearing so far, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, rate us 5 stars, and share with all of your true crime addicted friends. See you next time. Love, Revive.